As a non-commercial educational radio station, KZSC supports the free expression of ideas. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Regents, KZSC management, staff, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee at prc@kzsc.org or at 831-459-4726.
So I'm over here at KZSC right now, and my name is DJ Futterstomp, and you are?
Cut Chemist.
Cool. All right. Thanks so much for sitting down with me today. So where are you located right now? What are you up to right now?
I'm in LA.
California. Okay. Cool. And is that where you live like full time or?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Born and raised all my life. Yeah. I never really ventured too far, just probably because I've toured so much that I never really spent that much time here. So I never felt the need to go anywhere else because I was always touring in other places and traveling. So, I just kind of stuck around.
Cool. What part of LA did you grow up in? Where are you at now?
I grew up in Hollywood. And then migrated to Glendale, which is just kind of a suburb northeast of Hollywood, just by about 10 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay. So really, really like the same area.
Yeah. I kind of just stick around there and went to UCLA for college. So yeah, it's all just LA based right down the line.
So I kind of wanted to get started just hearing a little bit about like how you got started in music and what that kind of looked like for you and when that was and what kind of genres you're listening to or there's a particular inspiration and kind of just how that journey began.
Well, let's see. I mean, music for me, I was exposed to it pretty early. My dad was, he had like a small little recording studio, I guess you'd say. It was like a 4-track reel-to-reel, which, you know, it seemed so exotic to me when I was young. And he would write songs. He wasn't, you know, he didn't do it for a job, but he did it as a hobby. And other musicians would come over and bring drum sets and, you know, whatever, and play. And so, you know, I was fascinated with that, particularly with people hanging around playing live, you know, and seeing that and feeling that energy was so awesome. And then there was the music, you know, that was happening along with it. I think that just kind of stuck in my head as the years went on, and I formed my own group, and the house again became the house I grew up in, became kind of a center piece for people gathering and making music and jamming. So it seemed very familiar, not only to me but to my folks, so they were really supportive of it.
Oh, that's so cool. So they're on board with your journey too.
Like any kid listening to pop radio and, you know, loving Michael Jackson and you know, all that kind of stuff. But then when I was 11, I was exposed to hip hop through Herbie Hancock.
Oh, yeah.
Rocket, you know, which featured DST on Scratching, which was the first, I guess, real crossover progressive jazz pop song to feature a DJ. And so much that it reached my ears. And you know, with that you see people break dancing, and you know, you widen the scope and you see that it's this entire culture that's been happening, you know, for a decade maybe already. And so, you know, I was fascinated with that and had to learn more, and you know, eventually picked up breakdancing, graffiti, DJing when I was 11 and 12, and stuck with the DJing and the graffiti, and then the graffiti turned into me going to UCLA for fine art.
Wow, so you were DJing. really serious about the graffiti artwork and that whole scene.
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, I was serious about drawing and my can control wasn't great. So, I mean, at the actual graffiti on the wall, I wasn't so good at that, but I was really good, in the sketchbook.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I loved drawing ever since I was young. So I just, furthered that in my studies and got a degree in fine art. But at the same time, I was DJing as a hobby and then picked up, production. I started sampling and collecting records probably about when I was 14.
Wow.
14. I inherited my dad's 4-track reel-to-reel.
Oh, sick.
He let me have it. And then we started making demos in like 87. And that was with Charlie Tuna and Mark Seven.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, this is pre-J5, Jurassic 5.
Right, right.
And it wasn't until about 94 that we put out, you know, that we met Duck here and Akil and Newmark and made it a group.
Mm-hmm.
And collaborated and put out our first single, thus blossoming into you know, the career that it became.
Wow. So going back really quick to when you were, God, you said 11 and 12 when you were getting started. Before you were really collecting and getting into scratching and stuff, what were you like? What were you using to DJ on? How were you getting started? What was your first very like introduction to mixing?
Yeah, well, the parents' turntable,
mm-hmm.
Which wasn't great. you know, I bought the Rocket 12-inch Herbie Hancock, and I was trying to emulate what I was seeing on the TV. In the video.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow, he's taking a record, moving it back and forth.
Just starts, and so, starts yeah, scratching up to... all the parents' old records. And
right. Yeah. Suddenly, yeah, their record collection became, you know, completely destroyed. Yeah. But it was tough to do it on the Denon belt drive that my dad had. So then we went out and bought a direct drive Technique. It wasn't a 1200. Which was the standard turntable used by DJs, kind of mm-hmm. still is. But it was good enough to learn how to scratch. And it was, so I just had like one turntable and one mixer. And all I wanted to do was scratch. I didn't really care about DJing, like blending records or anything like that. I just wanted to go wicker, wicker, wicker all day.
Just make the cool sounds.
Yeah. And I had, you know, like a nice little modest rap collection. I mean, you know, rap records were, you know, there weren't that many out by 83, 84.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, enough to fill like a small shelf of mine. And so, those were the records that I would scratch with. And then eventually I got another turntable and then I started to pick up, you know, more DJ abilities, like, you know, blending and going back and forth and mm-hmm. all the little tricks. And then I was listening to a radio station out here that played hip hop and had specialty mix shows on the weekends.
Oh, cool.
And they were some of the best DJs in the world at the time. They were called the KDAY Mixmasters. And that's where people like DJ Aladdin came from, and Tony G and M-Walk, Joe wow. Cooley. And so I would listen to them scratch and mix, and I would try to emulate what they did by hearing it. Cause you know, back then we didn't have videos of people doing it. So you couldn't like watch tutorials. Like, you know, people are very fortunate now.
Mm-hmm.
You can watch a DJ do it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much on YouTube now that I mean, I've started kind of like just mixing on a little controller, and there's so much out there content wise to kind of get your bearings.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it's not
take virtual, virtual classes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Beat Junkies Institute of Sound, I think, offers virtual classes. They also have, you know, their school up, which is also in Glendale.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Street from my house, which is great because you see, like, 10-year-olds killing it.
Awesome.
I legit went in there one day, and there was, like, a 10-year-old, and yeah. He was better than I ever was.
What was he mixing with?
What was he mixing with?
Like, what music? Just curious.
Oh, it was. They would just throw on a beat and they would cut it up.
Oh, I
see. And they would do like a round robin.
Oh, that's so
between
cool.
some of the DJ instructors, some of the Beat Junkies, and then the students.
Wow.
And then when they got around it as kid, I was like, man. And they were like, and yeah, Babu was like, I'm serious.
Oh,
was,
I know Babu. So he does. He works with them down there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. That's
He's like,
awesome.
This kid's a problem. Yeah, he is.
Do you do like guest lectures there ever, or do like a teaching?
We're trying to figure it out. You know, since you know everything's back open and it's post pandemic, it's been kind of tough to schedule things because everything all at once, you know, is happening. But I do go there just to kind of go to their events and hang out with them because it's so close and they're like lifelong friends. So. Yeah, every time they're like, man, we got to figure out, you know, getting you in here and doing a lecture. I was like, hell yeah, anytime.
Yeah, that's so cool.
We just went in there. They had something with Pioneer where they demoed a new device, and it was pretty rad. And that was like a couple weeks ago. That was the last time I was there.
Wow. That's awesome. That's really interesting to hear. I'll have to look that up. I didn't even know about that. But cool. So kind of getting back to your timeline here. So you said kind of mid late 90s Jurassic 5 like fully formed, and that's when you guys put out your first mm-hmm. was it a mixtape, was it a
what? It was a vinyl single.
Okay.
So, or I would say EP because it had like four songs on it.
Okay. And mm-hmm. was it a like sample heavy thing, was it all scratch stuff?
It was it had a DJ track by me on one side, an instrumental by Newmark, mm-hmm. and then the rap song. It was all very heavily sample based. Sampling was all I really knew how to do. Mm. I wasn't so good with like synths and, you know, drum machines and stuff like that, drum programming. I was more of just like a loop guy, stacking loops, drum loops with bass line loops with, you know, whatever. And that's how I made that music.
Oh, cool. Wow, that's really interesting to hear. And so from there, how long was Jurassic 5 doing stuff together until you kind of like broke off and started doing solo?
I would say about, let's see, 94 to 2004, 10 years.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
And so that kind of lines up right with the audience is listening, right? And is that kind of, that your first project right
does.
After?
Yeah. I put out that record in 2006. Mm-hmm. So yeah, 2004 to 2006 was when I really got, you know, serious, stayed home and worked on it.
That makes total sense. And that record obviously ended up getting a pretty big amount of critical acclaim and everything, with kind of just all the tracks throughout, with Spoon and with the audiences listening itself. And what was the big inspiration for that album when you started working, and how did you get connected with people like Edan and kind of the other features on there?
To do something kind of like a fantasy world, you know, explore as much as I could into the concepts of rhythms and painting pictures with sound. I don't know, you know, I think, yeah, I was very visual as a kid listening to music because, well, I'll kind of try to set it up like this. When I was 5 years old, 6 years old, I would listen to the Star Wars soundtrack and imagine watching the movie.
Oh, that's really funny.
So, you know, because I couldn't go to the movie and watch it every night, even though I wanted to, because it was so spectacular. I would listen to the soundtrack. And so visualizing pictures in my mind as I'm listening to music kind of just became a thing. That's how I processed music in my head. Mm. And so making this album, I think I was trying to write my own movie. So there's like kind of some science fiction in there, you know, with the robots are coming.
Yeah.
You know, the big break. And I imagine that song in particular being surfing robots storming a beach.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that just sounds kind of ridiculous, but at the same time, kind of awesome.
I love that. I love the idea of there and going. I mean, I absolutely love that album. Huge album for me, actually. But going forward, listening to it, it'll be fun to know that there's a little storyline to each of those songs.
But imagine like the robots being these real clunky. Like, I don't know if you've seen the video, but kind of looking like that, like these big silver '60s kind of Fantastic Planet bots.
Oh, sick.
And or Forbidden Planet or whatever.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The thing is like because they're in the water, they fry up. You know, they're made from electronics, so it's completely ridiculous. Like they're surfing and they're destroying themselves because they're in the water and but they don't care, they're still doing it.
Oh man, I love that.
It's a zany song, and you know, there's like kind of a rockabilly element to it. I was hanging out with this DJ named Kev Darge, who was a huge Northern Soul funk collector, but he switched over to rockabilly and somehow that inspired me, and he started to play me all this great rockabilly stuff, and that's why that song kind of has that rockabilly edge to it. And then The Garden, which is probably the song I worked on the longest.
Yeah, and that's the big one too. That's the one that seems to have gone the most
That one notoriety. Just went through so many phases. You know, I completed the sample part of it, and then in 2002, I went to Brazil for the first time, and I hooked up with a samba school, and they played to it, and I recorded it.
No way.
And then brought those sessions back, and then, you know, worked on that with those elements, and that was just, it was a beautiful song to work on. But it was also painstakingly hard. It was trying to get everything just right, you know, just the balance of everything. Cause it just, you know, I'm detail obsessed, OCD to the max when it comes to like blending live elements with sampled elements. I have to make it so the listener can't tell which is which.
Huh. That is really interesting to hear. Cause that album or that song definitely stands out too on the album. With that, that's like, I feel like one of the vocals there. And are those vocals there from that recording you did in Brazil?
No, the vocal on that one is actually Astrid Gilberto. Astrid Gilberto. Berimbau, which already existed in the song, but I did try to get a live person to redo it. Didn't quite feel the same. And I had qualms about using something that wasn't like a rare record. But I had to let go of that and just be like, well, it sounds good. It's the best sounding one I got. So you should just bite the bullet and, you know, use a record that, you know, everybody can find. What's the big deal? And so I kept it.
Okay. So do you usually try to lean, just going off that really quick, do you usually try to like stay away in most of your work from recognizable samples? Do you try to stick to the more underground stuff?
You know, the DJ aesthetic in hip hop throughout the decades have always been having your own sound, and that means having your own records that are different from the other DJ's records, which leads to be very secretive and, you know, covering up the labels so people can't see what they are when you're DJing out, things like that.
Yeah,
that filters through with samples as well. And when you make music with records, you want to use something that's going to be uniquely you, that other people don't have. You know, people have let go of that a lot, but I held on to it for that album in particular. Even though one of the first reviews was like, none of the records he's using is rare, because of course they just gravitated towards the Astrid record and then like the Funkadelic intro. You know, they didn't pay any attention to like the Indonesian break or the, you know, psych record from Italy. You know, forget all that.
You're like, God,
but he used Funkadelic and Astrid, this guy, you know, forget him. You know, I you listen to people like Premier who also, they use rare records, but he doesn't hold on to that aesthetic as much, because he'll use very known records that everybody has, but the way he flips them is so unique. So that's his thing.
Right.
You know, like using, let's say, Cool is Back by Funk Incorporated, a funk record that's in everybody's crate, that everybody long retired. Like, mm-hmm. no way. I'm not going to use that drum break. It's been done to death. Well, here comes Come Clean, you know, by J.Ru, and he flips it, and everybody's like, what? He did that with that? That's amazing. And so that whole aesthetic of now using known stuff and flipping it different became a thing.
Totally.
Which is also, you know, incredible. And another side of hip-hop, which I can definitely respect.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's both sides of it. Like you're saying, there's not a right or wrong, but there's a way to get really creative and repurposing samples in a way. I recently sat down with Girl Talk up here, if you know him. And
yeah.
He does, you know, all those crazy mashup albums of, like, really all of them are recognizable songs, but his whole thing is repurposing those recognizable songs. So you know what it is, but in a way that you're not used to it, or to speed you're not used to it. So just you know, different ways to kind of to bring music to people's ears. And then on the other side of it, having samples that, you know, people don't know, and that creates a whole nother aesthetic, like you're saying. So it's definitely
interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, the garden, obviously, it's really cool to hear that was kind of like your creme de la creme. That really took a lot of extra work and painstaking labor. And it's also the longest track on the album by almost 2 minutes, it looks like. But yeah, obviously.
Yeah, the other thing about that song is it was the song that I used to demo engineers, like mixing engineers. And so our second engineer for the J5 Power Numbers album, this guy Kent Hitchcock, I said, listen, I'll let you take a crack at mixing this garden song, and if you even come close, then, you know, I want you to mix the whole album. And like a week later, he was like, come by and check this out. And I was like, you got the job. It was incredible. It just, you know, was way more open than my rough mixes. And but I mean, even that process, like the final mixes took like a year.
Wow.
And then just to let you know how OCD I get, the mastering process then took another year.
Hence we go from 2004 to 2006.
Exactly. Yeah, just not even really creating, just mixing and mastering.
Wow.
I had to go around the world and demo mastering engineers that I respected. Howie Weinberg in New York, Bernie Grumman in LA, and then I landed at the Exchange in London. And again, I was like, you guys got the job. It was so amazing the way they sparkled up my sample-based music. It was incredible. So I still use them to this day for mastering, the Exchange.
Wow, that's really cool to hear. So was in terms of the production process, before, you know, all the mastering and mixing, was The Garden the final piece that you were finishing up, or did more parts of the album come together after that?
More parts, I think. Like I said, The Garden was kind of mapped out first.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Like I knew, I really knew the direction that I wanted to go in. I just didn't have it at my disposal until I went to Brazil. You know, songs like Big Break were completely different. You know, it's funny what changes chorus in a song could be something as small as you finding a phrase and going, oh man, that works with this. But the title of that works with this too. So let me call my first big break. I mean, I should call it The Robots Are Coming, because that's what the thing says. But no, I think the beat sounds like a big break. And so I'm going to call it my first big break. Really, my first big break was kind of the beginning of the album. And it was meant to be different record collector friends of mine talking about the first time they found a big drum break on a record.
Oh, cool.
And so I did all these interviews, Biz Markie, Shadow, you know, Egon. Uh-huh. And it was going to be this whole pastiche of, you know, hot, rare drum breaks with these conversations. And then when I found the Robots Are Coming record, I was like, oh man, that's cool. And then that crazy, you know, beep, boom, cap, boom, cap,
yeah,
boom,
yeah. Cap.
I was like, oh no, that's my first big break. Scrap all the phone call, bull, you know, BS. Let's make it this whole sci-fi robot thing, you know, surfing. So
cool.
It was fun and difficult to make those decisions when you're like so attached to an idea and you've been working on it, then you're like, nah, let's get rid of that and just make it this.
Yeah, no, I can't even imagine.
Storm, same thing, you know, Edon and Lith got together.
And those are guys that you also worked with pretty frequently on Die Cut too, right?
Or I just love the chemistry between us three, you know? It's so fun and amazing and, you know, unique. They have just such a great back and forth. And I didn't even ask for Liff to be on it. I, you know, just wanted to do a song with Edon, and he was like, yo, can I get Liff on this with me? And I was like, oh, hell yeah, you know?
Yeah.
And so originally they were rapping to, again, another rare drum break on record. And it was cool. It was great. But it didn't sound like, you know, like I feel like that kind of had been done and I wanted to do something different. Mm-hmm. And so when I found this weird psychedelic electronic record that was French, I replaced that funky drum break with this kind of weird, I don't even know how to describe it, drum beat, and with like the scratching, and it's all really dusted and mixed horribly, but in a good way. I just put that under the verses, and I was like, oh yeah, this is hot. This sounds like completely nothing like this. I've never done anything like this. That's for sure. Whether somebody else has, I've never heard it, but I know I've never done anything that sounds like this. It was, you know, psychedelic. It was hip hop. It was like, it sounded old school, but it also sounded future. And it just made their raps really pop. And so that was another instance of me, you know, letting go of something that I've worked on for a long time and just going, we have to change direction. I was really dedicated to making this album different than what I expected, and hopefully different than what my fans expected. Like, I wanted to surprise people.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a really incredible project, all in all. I've listened to it countless times. I really fell in love with it.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Audience Is Listening came out, and then we have up until 2018 when Die Cut came out. In between that time, there's all this stuff on, you know, all these mixes on YouTube with you and DJ Shadow and on SoundCloud that I found. But what were you working on in that time? Because those are two studio albums there. What were you working on in that break?
Right. Well, let's see. I started working on Die Cut in 2008.
Okay. Wow.
And it all started with the record I sampled for Storm on Audience Is Listening. Mm-hmm. I sourced the artist and found him through MySpace, of all places.
Wow.
And came to this French group called Vox Populi. And I hit him up and I was like, I really love a lot of your stuff. A friend of mine that did visuals for me played me some other material by this group. And I think he found it through, I don't know what site it was, but some weird site that was dedicated to like cassette culture from around the world. Post-punk stuff, crazy, you know, early 80s, late 70s stuff. And he's like, yo, they have other stuff that's even crazier than what you sampled. And so he'd play it for me. I was like, wow. I found the guy on MySpace and I was like, listen, your stuff is blowing my mind. And I would like to I would like to sample more of it, number one. And number two, I want to put out a compilation and let people hear this stuff. So this guy's name was Axel, and he sent me, you know, original cassettes, CDs of unreleased stuff, and I was putting this comp together, and it's called Funk Off. And it's the group Vox Populi and Pacific 231. Just amazing stuff. So I spent kind of a couple of years putting that together. And at the same time I was compiling that material, I was also making songs out of it for Die Cut. Mm-hmm. And so Metal Storm, mm-hmm. which is the first song right. that was recorded for Die Cut. And then the Charlie Tuna song Work My Mind is also their material.
Oh, that's such a good one.
And then which other one? Rhythm Method.
Mm.
That's a also crazy one. A lot of them, like the synth, the main synth line.
Yeah.
Is them. And then, oh God, why can't I remember? Enough? There's another like two. I mean, that album is littered with these guys. And so, yeah, I mean, it all started with Storm and kind of blossomed into this whole thing that led to these two future projects. And yeah, so I don't know. There was that, and then that led to doing a mega mix with all their material. So there's the Funk Off mega mix, and these all came out on vinyl. So you know, handling stuff through my boutique label of manufacturing and distribution takes some headspace to where it takes you away from the creativity of working on another record. Mm-hmm. And trying to think of what else, like various remixes, Tune Yards.
Oh, really?
Remix, cool. Yeah, for Gangster.
Oh, that's awesome.
Obviously, the Shadow tours with, you know, product, but not product placement, Hard Sell.
Yeah, that one I love. That mix is wonderful. Both
Hard Sell, Renegades of Rhythm, you know, touring and more touring. So yeah, it really took a while. It took 10 years to, from inception to finishing Die Cut and putting it out, which also came out on my own label, you know, whereas Audience came out on Warner Brothers. So yeah, you know, it took kind of a couple of years to solidify distribution and, you know, how I wanted it to come out, stuff like that. I had to finance everything. But yeah, it's, I don't know if there's any other songs on there that you want to hone in on.
Yeah, I mean, I always have loved Moonlighting with Biz. That one's super special. I kind of found your stuff last year, and I kind of like right around, I was listening to the most recent Biz stuff, the stuff he did with Avalanches, and listened to some of his stuff on YouTube and kind of going down a little rabbit hole. And I remember right around that time, coincidentally, I was going through Die Cut, and I was like, no way he's on this too. And that track, I just love that one. I Got a Weapon too. That one's
a lot of fun. Oh, man.
Yeah. So both of those ones for me, for sure.
Yeah, the Biz thing, it was kind of a fluke. Yeah, he picked the sample.
Oh, cool.
And it's all pretty well described in my Biz podcast, my dedication. So if you get a chance, check out the Biz Markie dedication after he passed.
Oh, yeah.
But it's great. It's like me, Newmark, and my friend Mike Stiles. I had this whole other beat mapped out, and I was playing him stuff as we were hanging out, because, you know, we would hang out and buy records and when he would come into town. And I was playing on my stuff, and he was like, it's cool, whatever. And then this one little thing that I had before a beat is like kind of an interlude, a small short interlude thing. He was like, that's good. You should loop that and make a song out of that. If you do that, I'll rap to it.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, really? That thing? All right. So I did. And he just freestyled the whole thing. He got in my closet and, you know, turned on the mic and he spit a verse, like, off the dome. And that was it. And then I, you know, worked on the song, obviously, but it was so simple, minimal, and boom, it happened, you know, which is not the way I'm used to working. I'm used to, like, obsessing over detail for years on end to making a song perfect, but this was just like, boom, it happened, done. And there was something so refreshing about that.
Yeah, it's such a great song. I mean, it is, I kind of can, there is a certain, like, level of more simplicity in it compared to, like, some of the depth and the layering on some of the other songs, but just his lyrics on that and just kind of the feeling of it, it has a really great sound to it. Were you guys, did you guys spend a lot of time together outside of musical stuff too? Or just kind of in the studio?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, he was a record collector and so was I. So, you know, when he would come into town, we've been friends since like 93. Yeah. And that song was recorded in 2010. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think I would probably see him a few times a year. But it was less and less as time went on. I don't think I'd seen him for like a couple of years when he came to town that one time. And there's been other sessions to where, you know, he's just like, hey man, let's freestyle. get on the turntables. I'll get on the mic. You know, I've recorded other things like in the 90s at my mom's house. He was always so fun.
Yeah, he seems like an amazing guy. And he DJ'd and mixed too, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was super into it.
Which I didn't know when I met him. And when he came and DJ'd one of the clubs, I DJ'd at, and I, you know, because I invited him. Didn't think he was going to show up. I thought he was just going to hang out. I didn't think he was going to, like, DJ. And then he brought a whole box of 45s and DJ'd for like an hour. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I found some clip on YouTube of him like scratching like late, I think it was like late 80s, early 90s or something. But
yeah, cool to see. My mind was blown. And then he took me to a show at the Palace here in LA, and it was like a Bad Boy, the label Bad Boy, kind of when they were just getting started, it was like their roster lineups. It was like Biggie, Craig Mack, and I can't remember who else. And this is back when like Biggie was like low on the totem pole. It's like Craig Mack was the big guy on the label. And I'm sitting next to Biz, and he's like, "Hold on, I'll be right back." And he jumps on stage, bum rushes Craig Mack's performance, and battles his DJ like right there on the spot. It was just like only Biz can get away with that. You know what I mean? Because he's just such a teddy bear.
Yeah.
And it was funny, and it was, you know, it was cool. But yeah, man, good times. I miss that dude immensely. I think the Die Cut album was approached more like a singer songwriter album because, yeah, I wanted to collaborate more with people. I missed it. Audience listening was fairly isolated. It was me fantasizing, you know, in my studio.
Totally. I was going to bring that up too. Go for it.
Right. I think I missed my bands. You know, I was a Motley J5, and I wanted to create music with people again. So not only did I reach out to MCs, but I reached out to my good friend Carlos Nino, who I credit him as production assistant or assist something, but he like got the studio, got musicians, he got D'Anthony Parks, he got Farmer Dave, he got, you know, Mike and Nine, he got, you know, so
yeah, you've got a crazy range of artists on here. It's awesome. The DMTL too, and
Tune Yards, I think, maybe even came through him.
Yeah, wow.
And then there was like, there's so many other people, but we would rent this studio just walking distance from my house. And we would, you know, the guitar players, drummers, you know, MCs, singers, and we would just make music, and it was and it was awesome to sit there, and you know, I was playing guitar and writing music, like playing Jane, and writing music with other musicians, which I had never done before. You know, I would collaborate as a Motley as a DJ, but I was never really like, hey, I have this guitar line, you know, let's work it in there. Wow. And I always wanted to do that. I always wanted to be like a legit band member and a music writer. And I had the chance to do that, and it was awesome. Like, people took me seriously. And watching D'Anthony drum was like, I mean, he did 6 songs in a day.
Wow.
And I have those raw videos, and they're just, I couldn't believe what I was watching. The way he was playing. And it was just a really good, fun roster of talented people to make music with.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a really eclectic mix of artists, and it all works together. And I think the totally what you were saying earlier, it does have more of a, just so much more of a collaborative feel, which makes it such a fun. And then you still have, you know, some repeat artists with Edan, Mr. Liff, and Hymnal, and some of those sounds too still show through for sure, but it's also has a totally different feel.
Yeah, I wanted it to feel like we started audiences listening, and mm-hmm. then the minute Metal Storm ends, it veers off into a different direction. So, you know, establishing where we've been.
Gotcha.
And now we're going to go somewhere else.
Gotcha.
Because, I mean, it did, you know, it had been 12 years.
Yeah.
You know, for people. So they're like, wait a minute, what'd you do? Who are you? and then, oh, right, Laura Darlington.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
For Humbling From Home. She's the second song, I think, on the record. And she, you know, she originally sang for Rhythm Method. And I didn't think it was too busy. Like, it had too many elements in it. So I took her off and made her own beat for it. And it was, and became its own song.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why, you know, it's like in key and same tempo as Rhythm Method. And that's why they're back to back. They're pretty much companion pieces of music. But yeah, I thought it was cool to go from like some hard, you know, chainsaw rap to, this, you know, almost like broadcast sounding, you know, electronic, beautiful, singer, female singer. And then Rhythm Method was like supposed to sound like an electronic forest. That's kind of what I imagined for Rhythm Method.
Yeah, that's a really unique one. I've always been a fan of that song.
I think that's kind of this album's garden.
Yeah, I played that on air a couple times a couple years ago when I was doing a kind of like a sample based electronic kind of borderline like experimental rap show. I don't know. I was kind of just winging it, but that was one that I had a lot of fun with. So Die Cut 2018, and then do you have anything you're working on right now, or has there been any other projects that you've collaborated on since then, or kind of laying low?
Yeah, I work on a lot of music. I'm working on a couple things. I'm working on an album with Charlie Tuna.
Sorry, well, who was that? One more time.
I'm working on an album with Charlie Tuna.
Okay, cool.
Been working on it for a couple of years. We do a lot of shows together. So we figured, you know, let's do an album together. We've known each other for damn near 40 years. We've been in multiple projects together. Let's see if we can do something. It's getting there. You know, I think it'll be out this year, hopefully. And then I'm working on a world music record as well, but that one's a lot slower because it involves getting like vocalists from Ethiopia, you know.
Oh.
Or you know, I've done 2 songs. One's Ethiopian and then one's like more of an like South African kind of thing. But it's awesome. Again, all live. So it's interesting to go back into that and collaborate with musicians. But yeah, that's just going to be kind of a passion project. I'd say the Charlie Tuna one is definitely worth mentioning. And then, you know, I just do a subscription service for my fans. The pandemic has kind of caused me to figure out other ways to communicate with my fan base. So a subscription series is cool because I get to share all this exclusive stuff for patrons. And then I also do candlelight sessions at my studio for couples.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I get to, you know, do like an hour set of everything from like, you know, sweet soul ballads, psych rock, dirges, Ethiopian jazz. There's like a music menu you can choose from, like, oh, I want this, or a combination of all of them.
Wow, when did you get started doing that? That's awesome. I've never heard anything like that.
Well, at the top of the pandemic, I was doing these candlelight IG sets.
Like live streams?
Right, yeah. Just like simply playing records in isolation to a candle and having people watch it live. And then as Instagram was becoming more policing of copyright, these videos were getting taken down. And so I stopped doing them. And then when things opened up, I was like, you know what? It would be cool. I miss doing that. I want to do it, but maybe we can do it in person. And so it's a fun way to monetize that. And it offers, you know, an experience for people that, you know, I don't think there's anybody else doing anything like that. It's just me and them. And them and with a candle and dark room listening to, you know, these, you know, I hate to flex my record collection, but I will, you know, like original pressings of like, you know, cool records to listen to in a octagonal speaker setup. Like you are surrounded. It's like a musical sound bath.
Wow, that's really rad. That's super cool.
Yeah, I got one booked for February. Super excited about it. Because usually these people are also like, you know, foodies. Like they're like, oh, we're going to be in town and we're going to Bestia. And I'm like, ooh, fancy. All right. And we want to, you know, do this after we have our meal. And I'm like, yeah, that's what it's meant for. Because we also do like dinner and listening parties. Which is something I do with Edon. He flies out here and we do a 5-course meal paired with an album. But we don't listen to the album as we eat. We eat and then we listen to the album separately somewhere else. The entire record front to back with the speaker surround set up outside. In the elements, you know, it's out there. it's a lot of fun, and it you know, there's no visual accompaniment. You are, and there's no candle for that. It's just the record in the dark, and you're sitting there with your thoughts and this music, and people are like having. Well, the first album I think we did was Red Crayola, the first Red Crayola album, which is incredibly psychedelic, and yeah, people walked out of that going like. That felt like a therapy session. Like I was like rethinking my life.
Dang,
so yeah, I mean, you know, there's definitely, you know, dinner and music go hand in hand. So it's no surprise that people, you know, when they book this session, it's like, yeah, of course you guys are going to, you know, the city's finest restaurant in tandem.
Wow. What a cool niche little thing. I had no idea that was even there.
Yeah, it's offered on my website somewhere. Can't remember. There's like a little rabbit hole you gotta get to it.
And, cool. Well, just to kind of finish up here, curious if have you been through Santa Cruz before? Have you been to Felton before?
No, I mean Santa Cruz a bunch.
Okay.
Back in the day, it seems like in the 90s we played there all the time.
Where, the Catalyst or
Palookaville?
Oh, never heard of that.
Okay, yeah, this is I guess I'm dating myself.
No, it must have just went under or something.
Okay. Yeah, I used to go shopping at Logos for records.
Oh, cool.
But I had some friends go to UCSC.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time there in the early 90s, actually.
Wow, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm super excited to see you up at Felton. Well, nice. Great. Thanks so much for sitting down with me. Once again, this is DJ Futterstomp with Cut Chemist here at KZSC. And every time we do an interview here, we like to try to get the person being interviewed to say, like, you know, this is Cut Chemist and you're listening to KZSC. If you want to do a quick little sign off there.
Yep. Yo, what's up? This is Cut Chemist and you are listening to KZSC.
Ooh, awesome. Thank you so much, man.
You got it, and I'll see you at the show.
Cool, awesome.
All right, dude.
All right, bye-bye.